Mr. Kuswatwa in his appeal. I will attempt to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Now, Mr. Kuswatwa's appeal raises three challenges to his convictions. These are trial-based challenges, two of which concern evidentiary rulings made by the district court, and one raises a claim of prosecutorial misconduct during closing argument. With the time allotted today, and with the court's permission, I would like to address the two evidentiary issues that we raised in our brief, beginning with issue regarding the prior consistent statement that was admitted during the government's rebuttal case. As the court is aware, the victim in this case, who was referred to as KC, did testify. It is obvious from the record that she had a great deal of difficulty testifying. And her brief testimony on direct appeal, on direct examination, revealed that she had been touched by a man who lived in a red house on what was referred to as her ex, which the understanding was that was her genitalia. That was the extent of her direct testimony. The cross-examination, which was substantially more detailed, KC indicated that her statements regarding being touched by the man in the red house referred to an incident that occurred at her mother's house sometime previous to the incident that is alleged in the indictment. It occurred on a morning when a man climbed through the window of her mother's house and, again, touched her on the ex in the inside. The defense counsel asked KC during the course of cross-examination whether anyone had spoken to her about her testimony, whether anyone at any time had talked to her. She indicated that her mother had talked to her and that the prosecution had talked to her. She indicated she had also spoken with a police officer.
Well, the suggestion on cross is that the good cross was much more kind of incriminating than that. It was basically that you were told what to say here today by these people, right? And so there was a direct attack on her as having had a very recent motive to fabricate this whole thing. And the statements were directly over rebutted that, right? Because she made the statements that they wanted to introduce right after the thing happened.
First, Your Honor, I would disagree that, yes, there were specific questions about whether she had been prompted to testify as to what to say, whether defense counsel was making an actual charge of recent fabrication or improper motive. I disagree with that because the testimony that Casey was giving was not at all harmful to Mr. Kuswatwa's defense. In fact, it was quite helpful to their defense.
What difference does it make? What was he? Were you the trial counsel?
No, I was not.
What difference does it make? What was the trial counsel's mind? I mean, whether he or she had the specific motive, it seems as irrelevant. The jury would have perceived the line of questioning as calling into doubt, right? Whether KC was being truthful in reciting the things that she did in court that day.
Well, even the rule speaks of a charge of recent fabrication, but even if the jury were to perceive that defense counsel's questions were going in that line, the issue, the primary problem with the admission of this evidence is that it was not consistent. It was not a consistent statement. Casey's statement to Officer Jason Logg on the afternoon of the incident that's discussed in the indictment was not consistent.
Well, you do think that an individual has obvious problems. Doesn't it go to the weight? It doesn't go to admissibility, does it? It goes to the weight, and the jury makes their determination based upon the jury's determination, indicating her abilities to communicate, etc., and to find what truth there is in it. Are you saying that this testimony should not have come in? Or are you saying that this testimony proves your client is innocent? I don't know where your argument is going.
Our argument, Your Honor, is that the testimony should not have come in because it was hearsay. It was admitted as non-hearsay under Rule 801D1B as a prior consistent statement.
Now, I understand that you're not talking about the statements you made to the medical people, etc.
Not at this point, Your Honor. That is an additional issue I'm happy to address as well. This this evidence concerns the testimony in rebuttal, which is the last evidence that the jury heard, which came from a police officer, which was the only evidence the jury ever heard, that the man who lived in the wrecked house, well, in this case, in fact, the officer said, Mr. Theodore touched me.
Counsel, you mentioned earlier, and I was about to ask, you indicated the lack of consistency. You're not suggesting that these statements have to be exactly the same, are you?
No, Your Honor, not exactly the same, but if you, for example, look at the cases that are cited by the government in their answering brief, where they talk about exact consistency is not required, those cases really do make fine points about minor inconsistencies in the testimony, the prior and in court. Here we have testimony concerning an entirely different event, an event that occurred at the victim's mother's house at a totally different occasion. It is not a consistent statement. In fact, the only consistency is Casey's statement about what happened to her physically. Now, I agree, Judge Wallace, that Casey has difficulties and has limitations. But as the United States Supreme Court noted in the Tome decision, the court cannot change the rules of evidence based on the individual declarant. The rules of evidence are what they are. And in this case, the evidence was not consistent. In addition, the evidence clearly wasn't admitted to rebut a charge of recent fabrication. If you look at the government's closing argument, they never once talk about defense counsel's questions about this being recently fabricated. The entire focus was
it's not a requirement for admissibility that the prosecution didn't follow up in closing argument.
It's not a requirement, Your Honor, but it is noted by the Supreme Court in the Tome decision as a relevant factor. And actually,
the district court doesn't have any way of knowing what the prosecution is ultimately going to argue in closing at the time of the admissibility determination.
No, but it can be considered for purposes of determining whether it was error to admit it in the first place, Your Honor. That's our argument, that it was error because it really was not offered to rebut her recent, the allegation that she recently was offered for its substance. It was the only evidence they had as to the nurse's testimony. And turning to the nurse's testimony, Your Honor, our argument is also that that wasn't properly admitted because there is no indication that KC made her statements to Nurse Clinton.
So let me ask you what your position is on that issue. Are you saying that there has to be testimony from KC herself in which she, at least maybe on here, is interrogated about her exact understanding subjectively about what the purpose of the exchange was?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't have to be from the cleric himself.
Okay. What is it that was missing from this record that you think was necessary?
Well, you have to look at the entire context. And she testified she didn't even remember speaking with Nurse Clinton. She didn't remember her at all. And the rule does require that the statement be made for, it's a subjective test, it must be made for medical diagnosis and treatment. There was no indication that Casey's statements.
Okay, so just let me put the question back to you. What is missing from this record that you think was necessary to inform us about what Casey's purpose was in talking to the nurse?
In this particular case, perhaps testimony from Casey herself.
Perhaps you said that wasn't required. So,
well, you're asking what would it have meant.
But that's it. What else besides that?
Perhaps testimony from her mother about the reason the mother took her to this conversation she had with her daughter as to why they were going. But the evidence in this case shows this was a forensic examination that was conducted at the request of the police. Casey's mother was directed to take her for this examination. The night before she was
even missing something, was this person a medical individual? She wasn't a doctor, but you said forensic. Is there some conspiracy you're charging between the police getting hold of this person who really isn't a doctor and they're paid off on the side? This isn't what you're arguing.
Certainly not, Your Honor, but.
So we've been very clear that as long as the basic requirement is met, it goes to weight, and the jury makes a decision as to what the truth is. Why wasn't this sufficient to get to the jury? When she asked her how you are, what happened in relationship to this event that took place, what is missing?
Your Honor, that evidence from Nurse Clinton goes to the first, the second part of Rule 8034 that it issued, and I've exceeded my time, if I may answer your question. The second part, that it is reasonably pertinent to medical diagnosis and treatment. But before that, you must show that the declarant, Casey, made the statement for that purpose. There was never any evidence presented.
She made it for that purpose. Casey says that she has to get on the stand and say, I made this for this purpose. Or is the circumstance of her going to a doctor when she said this thing sufficient evidence to get over that hurdle?
It would depend on the context, Your Honor. If a nurse practitioner had a client brought in for example, a well examination, and it became evident that the child had been abused, that would be a different situation. Here we have a child being brought to a nurse examination. It's a nurse examiner at the direction of, and I'm not suggesting conspiracy, Your Honor. It's just the way the process works. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the defendants were allowed to rely on Rule 8034 to get victim statements in. If the court has no further questions, I've used my time.
We'll give you a minute for a moment. Let's hear from the government.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning, and may it please the Court, Helen Hong on behalf of the United States. The United States admits that the conviction in this case should be affirmed. The jury rested its unanimous verdict that the defendant is guilty of sexually abusing a young child based on competent admissible evidence. And I'll take the two evidence challenges in turn in the order that my colleague has addressed them. The first is the prior consistency. As this Court has already noted, the testimony from Officer Long identified a motive or a fabrication point that the defense objected to a cross-examination of the victim and rebutted that recent charge of fabrication.
You can address the consistency point.
The consistency point?
The victim's consistent.
And they are entirely consistent in this regard. During the victim's testimony on direct, she stated that the defendant had touched her on her ex. In effect, that sexual abuse had occurred.
Without reference to time or place, right? That's the problem.
There were signposts during the cross-examination that did identify that the statements were related to the trailer. So, for example, during the cross-examination,
I'm remembering that on direct, it was a very bare-bones direct for understandable reasons, perhaps. But basically, what was elicited from KC was testimony that something happened to her done at the hands of a man who lived in a red house. Right.
Right.
And that was basically the extent of it. There was no attempt to locate it and this happening in the trailer. Not even an attempt to locate it happening in the beginning of time, right?
Correct, Your Honor. And although I will note that there were signposts during the cross-examination that indicated that this was the event that occurred in the trailer.
Okay,
so for example,
on cross, the lawyer said, okay, now the testimony that you gave, I think, like this morning, or, you know, obviously referring to direct, let me ask you a question about where that happened, right? And she said it happened at my mother's house.
Well, she said she sort of agreed with everything that the defense attorney asked. So when she asked, did it happen when you were in eighth grade, the victim agreed. She was currently in eighth grade while she was testifying on the stand, meaning that the abuse had occurred on that day. When she asked about the events with the forensic interviewer, she agreed and then didn't agree. And it's evident from the cross-examination that this victim was someone who was going to agree with many things that the cross-examiner would ask.
But she saw the critical thing, though, she disagreed, right? When the person tried to get her to say this, it happened once, and she said no.
Correct. And I'll just add 2 points as an evidentiary basis. The United States was foreclosed from going into prior events. In limine, the United States had requested the opportunity to bring out 404B relating to the victim's contacts with the defendant on a prior occasion. The United States was foreclosed from doing that. As a result, the testimony that the United States elicited, and we saw this with Suzanne Clinton as well, had to be limited to the events that occurred in the trailer. Otherwise, we would have not met the 401 standard for relevance at all. So the victim's testimony was about the events that occurred in the abandoned trailer. And I do want to note that during the cross-examination...
I'm sorry, you were going to tell me that I interrupted you, but let me just turn you back. So how are the statements consistent when the testimony on direct, right, which is what we have to focus on, is not oriented to place at all? And then on cross, she fills in the detail, which is that it happened at my mother's house. there's a prior supposedly consistent statement that you want to bring in, is that this thing could happen somewhere else, right?
Correct. And we disagree with the premise of the cross-examination. It established that the victim's testimony was about an entirely different event. The event that the victim testified was about what occurred in the trailer. During cross-examination, she agreed with lots of things that the cross-examiner asked. In fact, she said that the abuse had occurred while she was in eighth grade, which means that it occurred right then and there. The events that happened in the home supposedly had occurred 1 month prior to the events in the abandoned trailer. So what the victim's responses during cross-examination reflected was that she was willing to basically say many things in response to the traumatic experience of cross-examination.
For consistency purposes, then, do you look at the entire statement of the witness, and do you look at the direct versus the cross-examination that you referred to? What parts of her statement do you look at to see if what's consistent?
The direct examination the United States admits was about the events that occurred on March 27th of 2014. What the defense has contended is that the cross-examination somehow muddied her testimony so that it was about an entirely different event. We disagree, and there are portions of the cross-examination that do reflect that when the victim was talking about being touched on her ex, that she was talking about the events on March 27th. So, for example, ER 843, the defense attorney asked the victim, now, when you describe what happened, did you remember being interviewed by a policeman after something happened to you? And the victim says, by a policeman. And the defense attorney then asked, yeah, by a policeman talked to you. Did anyone else talk to you besides a policeman? My mom. So the events that she described then, according to the cross-examination and the victim's own testimony, were subsequently followed up by an interview with a policeman. The only event that occurred that was subsequently followed up by an interview with a policeman was the event that occurred in the trailer on March 27th, 2014. What the defense tried to establish on cross-examination was that the victim was confused, that the victim could not recall what happened, where, and how. But the testimony that was elicited did indicate that the defendant had touched her on her ex. On cross-examination, the defendant attempted to suggest that it never happened at all. And therefore, Officer Locke's testimony that was elicited through just two direct questions was entirely consistent with the testimony that the United States elicited on direct, which is that the defendant had sexually abused her, that he had touched and licked her. So on both predicates, the United States admits that the United States' testimony that it elicited was both consistent and that it rebutted the charge that the mother had coached the victim and that the prosecutors had coached the victim as well.
And can I ask you, what was the nature of the prior contact with
The 404B request involved an event where the victim was found in the defendant's home in a laundry hamper, and that was excluded, which informs, again, what testimony the United States was permitted to elicit from the victim. Turning to the 8034 challenge, the statements to Nurse Clinton, Judge Wallace, to answer the question that you posed to my colleague, the Ninth Circuit has held that there is no requirement that there be testimony that the victim directly stated that she understood that her responses were for the purposes of medical diagnosis and treatment. In fact, this court's precedent indicates that the context in which the statements are provided alone can inform the question of whether the statements were made for the purpose of medical diagnosis and treatment. I direct this court to, for example, this court's recent decision in JDT, where the court looked at the context of the conversation and found that the provider's testimony alone about what was conveyed to the victim, as well as the provider's testimony of the purpose of the examination, that alone was enough to establish the predicate for 8034 purposes. That's precisely the case that we have here. In addition, cases in this court have blessed medical treatment and diagnosis statements for children as young as three. So Ignacio was involved a three-year-old victim. JDT was a six-year-old. Lukashoff, another case that we cited in our brief, involved an eight-year-old. The United States admits that in this case, the court admitted competent 8034 non-hearsay evidence, which was testimony that the victim gave to Nurse Clinton the day after the assault.
Let me answer this. Even though we may not require testimony from the declarant herself as to what her subjective thought process was during the exchange with the medical professional, I assume that your issues that there does need to be a sufficient evidentiary record from which we can nonetheless infer that it is a subjective matter. The declarant really did understand that it was for purposes of diagnosis or treatment.
In this case, that has been done, yes, Your Honor. So it is clear from, in most circumstances, and that's clear from this court's treatment, for example, in JDT, where it was a 6-year-old victim who was speaking to a clinical social worker. There they found that the clinical social worker's testimony about the purpose and what was conveyed to the victim was enough to reflect that the victim likely understood the purpose of the examination. That's what we have here. Nurse Clinton's testimony established that she, from the get-go, with children, establishes that the purposes of her treatment, or the purposes of the examination, is for medical treatment and diagnosis. So ER 507, she explained that it's well established by the time that she asks questions that I'm a healthcare provider and I'm going to try to help them feel better. That sort of testimony in full is what it is that the victim, in this case, Casey, necessarily understood, but she responded to Nurse Clinton's questions and then responded to the examination, underwent the head-to-toe examination, engaged in the subsequent sexually transmitted infection testing, engaged in the behavioral counseling that was recommended.
Okay, but I was surprised to hear, I didn't remember that one of our cases involved a 3-year-old. It strikes me as maybe a little bit too young for the inference to be drawn, but I assume that there, even you would concede that there is an age below which you just, it would be irrational for any court to infer that the child that young could even understand what the, like a medical purpose, you know, like a 1-year-old. I don't even know what age.
I have a 2-year-old, and I can say that he understands when he goes to the doctor what the point of the examination is. So for the bright line, sort of what age would be too young, you know, it's hard to say, but in this instance, we have an 11-year-old who certainly had the mental faculty of an 8-year-old. And this court's precedents beyond the 3-year-old have permitted statements from 6 and 8-year-olds, Lukashoff and KDT being examples. Unless the court has any other questions, the United States will submit.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's give you a minute for rebuttal if you'd like.
Very briefly, I disagree with my colleague's statement that there are signposts in the record to indicate that the direct examination of KC was about the incident in the trailer. The prosecutor asked KC, has anyone ever touched you on the X? And KC responded, yes. There was never more inquiry by the government as to when that accident occurred. So I disagree with the government that you can infer that Casey's very limited direct testimony was about the incident in the trailer, and that was the incident for which Mr. Kutswatawa was indicted and convicted. And I submit that the government is asking this court to take too great a leap in finding signposts that justify